Good afternoon. My name is Margaret Beatty, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum and the Anthropology Department, I'd like to welcome you to this afternoon's panel, Transnational Gender and Sexuality. The concept of transnationalism has been used as a window to understand the interactions between various racial configurations and ethnic and national identities. Sexuality and gendered identities are used by anthropologists seeking shifting cultural identities and forms of social organizations. Our discussion will explore how transnational relationships between cultures influence the most important issues affecting women today. This afternoon's panel consists of Professor Denise Brennan and Professor France Windance Twine. Professor Karen Kelski, who was originally part of the panel, was not able to attend. Denise Brennan is an associate professor of anthropology at Georgetown University. Her research focuses on the global sex trade, human trafficking, migration, and women's labor in Latin America and the Caribbean. She received a master's degree in international relations from Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a master of philosophy and PhD from Yale University. France Windance Twine is an anthropologist and professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Her research focuses on gender, girlhood, racism and anti-racism, feminist theory, critical race theory, field research methods, and multiracial and transnational families. She has conducted extensive field research in Brazil, Britain, and the United States. She holds a bachelor's degree from Northwestern University and a PhD in anthropology from the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Ann Hill is the chair of the anthropology department at Dickinson College and will be moderating our discussion. Her research focuses on ethnicity, kinship, and religion, and she has conducted fieldwork in both Thailand and Southwest China. At this time, I would like to ask that you turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Because we are taping this program and because some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before beginning to speak. And now, please join me in welcoming our panelists.
Good afternoon. I'm going to start off by posing a question to both of our panelists. And I have many questions on my list here. But at any point, after we get started here, if you have questions as members of the audience, please let us hear from you. We would be delighted. My first question is really a very fundamental one to this set of talks today, and that is the advantages of a transnational perspective to the study of and research on, in the case of Professor Brennan, love works and sex work in the Dominican Republic, and in the case of Professor Twine, ethnic heritage in Black Europe. That is, what advantages does a transnational perspective have as opposed to one that's focused on the nation, for example, as some sort of bounded unit in terms of your research?
Okay, let me start by saying I did my dissertation field research in Brazil. And one of the advantages I would argue, first of all, is that if you look at one of my areas in graduate school was the African diaspora. So if you're interested in migration and or diasporic populations, a nation-state frame is inadequate, both theoretically and empirically. And if you think about, for example, the slave trade, the transatlantic slave trade, which was central to the foundation of the U.S. economy and the economies of the Caribbean, you can't actually look at the African descent populations in this hemisphere without a transnational frame, I don't think, because you can't understand, for example, the British destroying the cotton industry in Egypt and then setting up cotton plantations here, which, and then that cotton is shipped back to textile factories in northern England, and then it creates the labor aristocracy in England, which, you know, and also the Liverpool elite financed and insured slave ships. And so if you want to understand the production of the banking system in Europe, the English aristocracy, the English middle class, the labor aristocracy in Europe, you can't understand that without a transnational frame. And you can't understand how ethnic and racial categories were actually produced, because we take racial and ethnic categories for granted, and we take racial and ethnic identities, we tend to take those for granted, but they were produced over several hundred years. So I would argue, so in my case, I was interested in understanding the differences and similarities between the U.S. and Brazil, which are the two largest countries in this hemisphere, and two large slave societies. I mean, both of these countries were founded on plantation slavery. Going to Brazil enabled me to understand more clearly our inability to really carefully think about class inequality in this country, because we have a very different discourse in the U.S. compared to Brazil. Also, I was interested in kind of the white working class and why Brazil didn't have the same history of racialized violence that we had in the U.S. I'm thinking here of organized white supremacy, the Klan, things like that that didn't exist in Brazil. And it's important to, so a comparative frame enabled me to really think carefully about how the way I learned to think about race and class was shaped within the U.S. national context, but it made me unable to really clearly see, until I went to Brazil, how it worked in another right context. But once I went to Brazil, I actually had a better understanding of class here, if that makes sense. So I think for young people, for young scholars and emerging scholars today, I don't think there's anything you can really adequately understand without a transnational frame. Just think about the current subprime mortgage crisis. I'm sure everyone's heard of that. Okay, so I was living in London last year for 6 months. I was at the London School of Economics. And when I was in London, they were already feeling the effects of the subprime crisis there because of the relationship between British banks and U.S. banks. You know, because we're talking about a global banking system, right? And it was in England that I first began to understand, a year and a half ago, the subprime crisis, because they were actually dealing with it and talking about the weakening economy here, plus the fact that I could only afford to buy carrots, like the value of my dollar. my money was like paper money. I felt like I was playing Monopoly, because every week the value of the dollar was dropping. And so what I could literally afford to eat was affected by what was happening here. But it was also registering, that crisis was registering in England and Germany. So I think even if you're not interested in transnationalism, you can't really understand what's happening here without a transnational frame, without seeing the links between these banks. And so that would be my first response, which is not even an academic one, just a basic, to be a citizen, an informed citizen, I think you need to have a transnational frame.
My work on the Dominican Republic, I talk about three transnational processes that take place in this one locale, this one little town. So you've got tourism, you've got migration in and out of this town. You've got two kinds of migration. You've got these expats from Europe who are coming to live out their neocolonial fantasies. So you've got working class folks from who are literally leaving behind factory jobs in Europe selling their cars and their condos and moving into a house with a swimming pool with a full-time maid. And then you've got Dominicans who don't have legal migrating networks off the island who are using this transnational meeting ground as a way to meet folks who have a citizenship elsewhere. They hope to mutually fall in love and then get a legal sponsorship of migration off the island through marriage. So I think there's an overuse of the terms and a lot of confusion, particularly in undergraduate classrooms, between what globalization is and what transnationalism is. And so I like to think of transnational processes, things like migration or war or tourism. And I also think about transnational networks, transnational feminist activism or transnational labor activism. The book I'm writing right now is on the trafficking of folks from all over the world to the United States. So what does that mean? People who embark on a migration to the U.S. illegally. They're paying people maybe to get them here. Or they're coming with a family and their employee, or they sign up to work in a factory. And then something goes awry, and their labor is in some way rendered coerced. And, you know, when I think of a transnational framework, I think of all the activism that's going on as well in feminist networks and in labor networks to try to prevent such extreme versions of labor exploitation before people ever leave. It's really difficult to do. I've gone to trafficking prevention workshops, for example, on the ground in little places in the Dominican Republic, because right now we have so many economies, as Windancer's pointing out, their largest GMP is remittances that are sent from their compatriots that are abroad. So many have written about sort of transnational citizenry. So we have nation states now that are trying to recapture that money, and they give lots of tax breaks. So they make it really easy, for example, if you're sitting in the U.S., to buy a house in Mexico. So you've got... I lost my train of thought talking about transnational citizenry. I wanted to say something about activism. I'll just stop there because I lost my train of thought. It's been a long day.
There's a question in the back.
I'm taking out of the word. Is there a favorite question?
Yes, go right ahead.
I'll actually do a segue from your lost thought to one that captured mine. And actually for Professor Twain, in terms of thinking about transnational racial networks here and thinking about, for instance, both African-Americans, Afro-Venezuelans, Afro-Brazilians, sort of thinking about the work that they're doing and the ways in which that informs people's respective understanding of race and class. I'm thinking about what you were talking about, of learning more about U.S. race and class relations in Brazil than when you were here. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that, of how you see the two countries different. And I'm thinking, in some ways, of Michelle Roth Trullo's comment that our contemporary racial relations in the U.S. and Brazil are also affected by the respective understandings of slavery.
Okay.
So that's a big question. But
so you want me to comment on more on the relationship, how Afro-Brazilians link to the view of the U.S. or the relationship?
Well, actually, in many ways, what you learned about race and class relations and how they're different here and how they're configured in Brazil, and I guess the other layered part of that question is, to what extent are some of the transnational racial networks and activist movements helping to inform the discourse in comparative race and ethnicity?
Okay, that is a big question, but I'll try. Well, first let me say that all nations have origin myths. And so when you think about the U.S., ours is we have the Anglo-American or Anglo-Saxon. It started out with myth that they were the chosen people. And so our national mythology, and historians have written about this, people like Reginald Horseman, have documented how Anglo-Saxons, the English, quote, founding fathers, created a national origin myth here, which is that they were God's chosen people, they were a superior race, that's what enabled them to kind of establish the institutions we have, democratic institutions. So we have a national mythology that was employed to incorporate European immigrants, get them to submit to Anglo hegemony, you know, in other words, give up your language, give up your accent, drop the SKI at the end of your name, Rosenthal becomes Rose, blah, 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 right? So the quote, melting pot or burning pot, as some of us say. And that myth was very useful in consolidating Europeans who then became constructed as white here legally and getting them to kind of go along with Anglo-hegemony, and we get the American dream. But all of this was obviously based on the exclusion of blacks, Native Americans, at different moments, Mexican Americans. And so I'm getting to the comparison. So one thing that I learned immediately when I went to Brazil, there was a different national myth. The national myth in the U.S., and you can see this when we celebrate our heritage, how you have to kind of erase slavery. It's Black History Month now, so this is kind of the shortest month of the year, as I like to say, and the one month where we get to talk about black people. Black History Month, by the way, is in October in England. But in Brazil, the national myth was we're racially mixed. We all have, quote, a foot in the kitchen, you know, which is basically we all have slave ancestors. This is what the white elites will say in Brazil. And it's a myth that places emphasis on what they call the racial democracy, but minimizes class they had a different system because literacy wasn't really promoted in Brazil until much late in their history, if you consider when Brazil was set up in the 1500s, and they really didn't have a national educational system to the 1930s. But if you compare the two countries, you see that in the U.S., we had a situation in which we had to convince white Americans who were poor, who didn't move up, that they still had some advantages, that, as Du Bois would say, the wages of whiteness, they still were going to get a psychological wage. And in Brazil, because Brazil didn't have the same American dream myth, this whole notion that everyone can move up, and they actually had more mixing among working class peoples, their myth became race is not a problem here. We don't have those barriers. And of course, they didn't criminalize interracial marriage. They didn't need to do that. They did abolish slavery later than we did. But they have a myth that basically positioned them as superior to the U.S. on the dimension of race. The U.S. became central to Brazil's national identity in the sense that they could say, we don't have those same problems here. We don't have the Klan. We don't have organized white supremacy. Our poor people get along. That is actually still central to Brazil's national identity, and so the U.S. became central in the way that the former Soviet Republic was, and Cuba has been important for us, right? We could tell poor people here what at least, you know, before the Soviet Republic collapsed, it's so bad in the former Soviet Republic. It's so awful there. You know, you're so lucky you live here, right? And so when you talk about the relationship between let me go back to Brazil and the U.S., both countries had to manage the black populations and the white populations, right, and figure out how to maintain harmony, but they had different demographics. And one of the things that's really interesting is in the 1920s, so there are three things I want to say. One, in the 1920s and 30s, the U.S. government colluded with Brazil in denying black Americans visas to go to Brazil as tourists. And the reason for that was that the language barrier wasn't enough to prevent the influence of black, you know, we had a negritude movement, Harlem Renaissance, the New Negro, blah, blah, blah. So we had a black intelligentsia that was forming and that really blossomed in the 1920s during the Harlem Renaissance. And so the Brazilian government was actually concerned about having too many Americans, black Americans, go there and interact. So that's number one. You have these two governments colluding, right? Second thing, you had, after the Civil War in this country, you had white plantation owners move to Brazil with their slaves to set up shop again, right? And so you had a situation in which Brazil didn't abolish slavery until the late 1880s, 1888, but they didn't abolish it the way the Americans did. They did it in stages, right? So they had this law of the free womb, like you know, so the two countries, the elites in these two countries have had a long-term relationship in which they've compared and contrasted, and Brazil did something else, which is they rejected some of the most vulgar aspects of scientific racism in the 1930s, right? This whole, you know, the whole scientific justification that blacks were inferior, that racial groups were ranked. The Brazilian government and the Brazilian elite realized that they had to reject that because they had, whites were a numerical minority. So one of the big differences that, one of the quote solutions is that the Brazilian government came up with this idea, we're stuck with all these colored people and they outnumber the white people, but we can whiten them slowly. Everybody can be, you know, become a little, the whites can become a little browner, the blacks can become a little lighter. And that was brilliant because it basically convinced the African descent population that they could be assimilated, they could be included, you know, they could be absorbed. And it was more positive. I think it psychologically that was probably experienced, at least this is what's been argued, as more positive than the U.S. black experience, which you will always, you know, you are a pollutant. And as we know, until the 60s, you cannot ever be completely absorbed. So I think the comparison, if we compare the two countries and we look at the difference between a Jim Crow system that created parallel institutions, the benefits of that were a black intelligentsia formed in an earlier moment, and then you compare that to the Brazilian. And it's not that one is better than the other, but what we can learn is how elites in different countries manage their racial, quote, their racial problems and try to generate solutions that enabled them to feel positive, to create a sense of nationalism and national unity. And I think that's really important when you're interested in social justice, just understanding how different countries generated solutions to help get people to participate and feel good about their nation regardless of their position. So, and Antonio Gramsci obviously can help us with this too. But I would just say Brazil, studying the Brazilian situation enabled me to understand how difficult it was for me to see how class worked here because we're so focused on race in this country. We can see that in the current election that's going on, in the current campaign, that we have a tendency to deny the degree of class inequality. And that is one strategy that the elites in this country have used to control and mollify the white working class population. And so I think that So I just want to say, you look at national mythologies, you look at strategies employed by elites in different countries, and it enables you to dissect and diagnose the things that are still happening, like here, and also how demographics and locality matter, because these two countries had very different demographics. And Brazil was competing with the U.S. and Argentina for white immigrants. So that was another issue in the turn of the previous century. That was one of their other problems, is the U.S. was getting all the European immigrants. So hopefully I, you know, gave you some sense.
Thank you. Maybe we can turn also to the Dominican Republic and see some of the dimensions of race there, racist or racial expectations that tourists bring into the Dominican Republic. I know you talked about this to some extent in your paper. And whether or not some of these expectations of a raced sex worker, for example, whether or not these become hegemonic in the sense of that they determine the behavior of sex workers and fulfill the expectations of sex tourists.
Well, I mean, in terms of origin myths, the Dominican Republic has this imagined Indian past. So the Taino Indians that were through the area were completely obliterated through the colonial conquest. And Trujillo, dictator, literally wore pancake makeup. I mean, he made himself a clown to make himself white. So there's this very troubled, disturbing racial taxonomy, including in language in the DR, where blacks, the word black, is reserved only for Haitians, and Dominicans are a whole other rainbow of descriptive terms. So in this tourist town, you've got Dominicans, you've got Dominican Haitians or Haitian Dominicans, you've got Haitians, you've got these primarily white Europeans. A lot of people ask me, what about black Europeans or black Americans traveling to the DR? And really, the time I was there, there weren't many. I understand that now there are, I mean, a lot of Dickinson students might be going to the Dominican Republic for spring break. I noticed over the past few years that there's some really great packages for U.S. folks now to travel to the DR. It's now become a more sort of sought-after tourist destination and very economically affordable. But I think what I really try to emphasize in my writing about Dominican sex workers, as Heather pointed out earlier, is it's hard to look for successful attempts at people who are left out of the sort of driving globalization. You know, it's hard to look for accounts of them really taking advantage successfully in a sustained fashion of the so-called opportunities opened by globalization. And, you know, I write about writing on a walking a feminist tightrope always. You know, anthropologists, yes, we look for signs of agency or resistance, but very careful not to over-romanticize that. And unfortunately, I told stories today of women who establish relationships and are getting some money wires or promises of migration, and then things dry up. But I think what's really important there is to see how they are taking advantage of racialized stereotypes of them. And, you know, arguably playing to what the imaginary is that they're imagining that the white man is thinking of them. And as I mentioned earlier, the white man is always imagining about the white woman at home that's a pain in his butt. So, you know, it's interesting in these interstices of global encounters, even when there is such inequality that prevails, to look at folks who avail themselves of you know, what they can. And maybe it's turning a stereotype on its head. I also want to say there's a there's two different groups of Georgetown students going to the Dominican Republic in the next couple of weeks. One of them is a group of young scholars who are extraordinary young scholars who are in a group called the Patrick Healy Fellows, and they're minority students, and they're going to sit with some NGOs that are looking at racialized identity in the DR right now. And then another group of students are, I'm the faculty advisor for this student facilitated course they're running on anti-sweatshops. It's a anti-sweatshop course. And they're going down and they're going to be connecting with transnational labor activists in different factory settings. So it's exciting to see young people linking race, I shouldn't say linking, situating race as a central analytical point, jumping off point for their research and their activism. And earlier when I said, you know, many folks don't really, they think of the DR in Haiti as this, you know, forgettable island. I think these points of that have this violent colonial past, Brazil, the DR in Haiti, bring us all the more acutely to what Windance was saying earlier, and that's this undeniable transnational, not only present, but past.
May I say something else related to that? I've been talking about my Brazil work, but for the past 10 years I've been working in the UK. And one of the things I just want to say is that we haven't mentioned militarism in this discussion yet. And the work I've been doing in the UK, which is about interracial family formations and how people manage race and racism in their intimate lives. One of the things that struck me when I first went to the UK was the significance of militarism and colonialism in migration patterns. And, for example, this book that I've recently finished that will be published later this year, one of the things I talk about is how the white women who I came to know and learned so much from, some of them had formed relationships with U.S. black men who went to England as soldiers during World War II and then after. And their images of black men were formed by Hollywood films that circulated. And I know this is sort of interesting because Hollywood doesn't have the best racial history, as we know. But one of the things about the UK is that one of the things about being black and leaving the U.S. is that you can be an American when you leave, and you can represent the U.S. in a way that's different than being here. So one of the interesting things is that many of the interracial relationships that I mapped that began in the 1950s involved men who'd been in the military. And by the way, this is true for the history of the black community in Liverpool, which has the oldest black community in England. Most of the black men in that community were seamen who worked for the British and established relationships with local women. But in the case of my own research, to link up with what you were saying, so these women, these local women, have watched these Hollywood films, right? And they're describing to me the films they watched. And so they have this image of Americans. And to them, black soldiers were Americans first. Americans with the flowers and the roses and, you know, all the things you see in Hollywood films. And so, and they would contrast that with the working class English guy propping the bar up, because that's the stereotype of the English guy, like drinking and not. But the point is, those stereotypes about American GIs benefited black GIs in this particular situation. and they were able to establish relationships in a context in which we had Jim Crow segregation here. And even though the British government tried to restrict those relationships, because the U.S., the Americans obviously did not want interracial relationships. And so there were a lot of policies that were established to try to restrict them. But the problem was the British didn't want to be viewed as setting up a Jim Crow segregation system, and they wanted to be perceived as more tolerant, so they weren't willing to set up the same restrictions. But the point is, racialized stereotypes about black masculinity interacted with positive stereotypes about Americans who had money and would buy you candy and flowers and chocolate, and among white local women. And in some ways, both the black men I spoke to, and I'm talking about U.S. black servicemen now, and white women from working class families felt that Hollywood representations gave them a zone of liberation and constrained agency, which kind of parallels some of the things you were trying to describe today. So on the one hand, the white men argued to me that the white women were strategically dating black men to get goods, to get things that were rationed. So flowers, cigarettes, perfume, not food stamps, what do you call it? Ration stamps. Yeah. Because for any of you who've lived abroad, you know that the U.S. military has the best stores and shopping malls in every country, if you go to the base.
But that's so wild that these black bodies are sought after there, and then meanwhile they can't use the restroom back at home under Jim Crow.
Right, but that's the point, right? That's actually the beginning of the civil rights movement, really started with the desegregation of the military. So it's interesting because in my own research I started to be confronted with this paradox, which was that the white men felt disadvantaged by nationality because they couldn't offer the same things materially. We're talking right after, during and after the war, and because Britain was devastated. And they denied that these were romantic relationships, right? So they tried to minimize the love and affection and argued to me, that these were just strategic economic relationships. And the same thing was said by anybody who was opposed, black and white. Most of the people I interviewed who were opposed to interracial relationships in their family would argue that the white women were strategically using the black men for upward mobility, and that they were only going after upwardly mobile, either U.S. or U.K. black men. Now, there was a lot of evidence to contradict this, but this is one of the discourses employed to demonize, denigrate, and dismiss these relationships. And so I thought I would point that out. So national context matters, and nationality matters just as much as locality, because in the case of the U.K., being an American, being with a black American was a better deal, or viewed to be a better deal, than being with the Caribbean. Why? Because of what the U.S. military provided financially. One example, and I'll stop, is a cooked breakfast. I'd never heard that term before, because we usually just say breakfast. The women who married U.S. black men said that they were the first in their family to have a cooked breakfast, which meant you had access to eggs, cooked meat, things that even today are not as common among working class families, as opposed to a cold breakfast, right, of cereal, or a breakfast that is basically leftovers from the meal the night before. Because, traditionally, we don't think of this. In most communities, traditionally, breakfast was whatever was left over from the day before. It wasn't a separate, distinct cuisine. You didn't have, quote, breakfast foods. So I'll end it on that. But the point is just that stereotypes about blackness, masculinity, and white femininity were employed by various actors in these communities to try to police white women, basically, to police their relationships.
which I think may lead us to think about sort of pervasive notions of modernization, westernization, you can become more particular, Americanization, as if this is some kind of pervasive, almost an inevitable swamping of local cultures with American images, films, or images of American images of the sexualized brown body and so forth. What have you both found about the reality of this? This assumption that westernization somehow is wiping out local culture, that it is inevitable, and after all, from a U.S. point of view, we have a better system in any event.
Well, I can just quickly say that one thing I find interesting about tourist encounters is that often those who are visiting look really stupid there. I'm going to speak in a stereotypical way, but most of the sex tourists who come down can't dance the merengue. I'm putting myself out on a limb here that they don't dance the merengue as gracefully, as hot as their Dominican counterparts, male, women, 82, 2 years old. So I think what's interesting is to look at what is the local social capital and how people parlay that, right? Mm-hmm. And then what gets really disturbed, and now I'm thinking of, you know, sort of racialized bodies traveling through space. For example, and I hinted at this earlier in the talk, and I didn't quite get at it, that you've got Dominican sex workers, or Dominicans, let's say, some of the resort workers, who have certain social capital in the DR context. Everything from they know which clubs to go to and they speak a language that the visitors don't, to this display of things that are valued in the tourist's mind on the dance floor or in bed or wherever, you know, whatever they're doing behind closed doors. And then when some of these women, Dominican women or men, go to live in Europe, in some of these working class towns, where there is not an established migrating network. So in other words, you turn on your TV and there's not a Spanish-speaking language mm-hmm. channel. You can't go to a store locally and get some familiar ingredients. You don't have social networks of folks through which you can create your own social space. And so now you've lost, I mean, you have literal capital. I'm now speaking about Dominican women sex workers. You might have more capital, but you've lost your social capital. So I interviewed some women who actually returned, mm-hmm. and they were gossiped about as being foolish and silly, and how could they do this? It was very difficult to have women describe how they were treated racially. They were very resistant to saying that they experienced racism. But then they would tell narratives of actually mothers-in-laws. It all ties together. Who would comment on their cooking. And but I think much of, you know, this, the idea of taking a locale and a lifeways and bringing, you know, reestablishing immigrant communities in spaces that don't, as I said, don't have these established migrating networks, they become pioneers in a number of ways. And then it brings us to the issue of if they have children, right? And then many of the women I met who went to Germany would have kids with white German men, and decide things didn't work out, and then they, you know, they bring them back to the DR, and lots of commentary on how they have good hair, and, you know, these sort of attributes of whiteness. So they bring back more social capital to the DR, but without the literal capital in their pocket.
I think I'll use food as a metaphor again. People are really creative, and in the post-migration communities in England that I studied, You know, we could all go to the store and buy the same five vegetables and come home and cook something totally different with it. So I found that American pop culture, for example, was just, it was like a raw material that people use, but it doesn't replace patois. It doesn't replace Jamaican jerk chicken. You know, it doesn't replace the queen on their money. Yeah. You know, the English are very, they're not part of the EU. I mean, the EU, the euro. And so in the case of England, I think they're still struggling with, I think their relationship to the U.S. complicates their relationship with continental Europeans. But what I saw is a borrowing of some aspects of U.S. popular culture, but remaking it. I mean, if we think about Amy Winehouse, who just got several Grammys the other day, you know, she's British hip-hop, for those who don't know, and she's basically reinterpreting 60s soul. But it's her interpretation. She's English. She's doing it in her way. So there's basically, I would say, a dialogue, a dialectic, and things flow back and forth, but they get transformed and remade in the process. I don't see, if you read Paul Gilroy and other British cultural theorists, it isn't like just that the U.S. is this hegemonic force. We're part of some of the raw materials that Europeans use, in this case the English, but they're remaking it in a local context and based on their own migration histories and their own cultural values.
I know you talked about respectability when you were talking about white mothers creating ethnicity among their children that had black fathers.
Right.
And I was reading your paper and also trying to get a grip as well on this notion of social capital, which really is one interpretation of respectability, I guess. How is that? Is that a factor in among not just sex workers, but in the Dominican? I'm sure it is the Dominican Republic generally. But how do sex workers deal with these issues of respectability? Are there symbols? Are there kinds of social capital that they deploy that could stand in for, say, the neat hair and the certain foods and so forth as being respectable?
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things about the use of the sex trade for transnational migration is that once you migrate somewhere else as the wife or girlfriend of somebody, in order to be respectable, you can't have met your man in the bar. So there's this very bizarre almost refusal to be brought into some social networks, which may be from home. So, and I forgot to mention that adds to isolation. So if there are some Dominicans near you, you may not want them to know you, because if they hear that you met in Sosua, or maybe they know somebody who knows somebody, there's this fear that it could get back to your mother-in-law. And I think on the island for sex workers, what's I found to be this the weight of motherhood in the way that Dominican sex workers had to present themselves, why they were selling sex. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, carefully concealing if they were spending any money on themselves and not on the elders in their family or on their children. And that would render, it would almost, it expands, I mean, Handag Nusotello and others have written about this idea of transnational mothering. And I think that, you know, in many of these out-migrating economies, the Philippines, the DR, Mexico, where you see mothers who are, you know, literally not in the same, under the same roof as their children growing up, right? it expands our notions of motherhood and respectability. And I actually would argue, you know, some migration scholars wouldn't agree, that for migrant sex workers, whether they're internally migrating or out migrating for sex, that they are also recasting notions of respectability into there's room within an idea of being a good mother if you're sending money in a regular fashion and you're you know, keeping your children away from the sex trade. Right. And that money, the money that can pay for education and can pay for food and a comfortable lifestyle, that can, you know, weigh out any kind of shame, especially if it's kept quiet.
Yeah. You know, we see the same things in this country. I don't know how many people read The New Yorker, but The New Yorker does a money issue every couple years. And about 3 years ago, they did a money issue, and they covered prostitution in Nevada. And one of the things that was interesting was I can't remember the name of the ranch, or, you know, it was a brothel. But one of the things that was interesting is the women, they interviewed these women, and they made the same argument that you're making, which is that they really enjoyed their work because, first of all, they didn't live in Nevada. They lived in other states. And they traveled and worked a few days a week at this brothel. And they made enough money to send their children to private schools. They did what they call specialty sex, you know, like fantasies and stuff. And I don't remember all the details, but what I remember was just thinking, wow, because the owner basically talked about how great the work conditions were and their reputation was protected because they didn't live in that community. They just went to that community. They did their 3 days. They made enough money. They came back. Their kids didn't know what they were doing. And they were able to provide for them very well in California and wherever, because some of them have. But basically, they argued that they were better mothers and that their children, they were sending them to, like, top boarding schools. And I thought, wow, this is really, and it was the money issue of The New Yorker. That's what really, but it was basically about how do you maintain your respectability. And the argument was that, and I'm not advertising for this guy, by the way. I'm not supporting it. I do think prostitution should be legal. But their argument was that they were maintaining their respectability, their privacy, and able to provide for their children and had better work conditions than they would have had in other jobs. They worked with other women, you know, the sisterhood argument. You know, we could throw a party together for these guys, you know, because they'd have guys come in. So it was, after reading it, I thought, okay, I buy some of this. I mean, I didn't want to go work there, but I remember thinking, this is an interesting argument. And I was convinced that in the situation of these women, they didn't have better options. Because most of them lacked a university education. They weren't. But anyway, it fits into your analysis. And my point is just women do that here, too. Mm-hmm. Women who... I lived in New Orleans for a year. That's where my mother's from. And I knew women who were in the sex industry when I was in New Orleans. And they were not disrespected in the community. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't study it. Right. These were just people I knew from going out, not to brothels, but just knew in the community. And I think they were negotiating very similar things to what you were saying. Because prior to Vegas, prior to the mafia setting up Vegas, New Orleans was the sex tourist capital of the U.S., really until the 40s. So I think similar processes were occurring here that are now being exported out.
Yeah, I can, because I worked in Thailand for... 2 or 3 years, quite a while ago. I know that sex workers want to get, female sex workers usually want to get out of the business as soon as they can accumulate enough capital to go into hairdressing or a dress shop, or they've sent enough money home. But my point is that there are, most of them don't have children. And what they are sacrificing for is their parents.
Mm-hmm. It's a very strong filial daughter argument. And that in itself is a source of respectability. And if they can support their parents well in the village, there are lots of new houses all over as a result of the sex work. And they can go back to the village. There aren't any men they can marry, less because of their lack of respectability than because most of the men there are married, or they themselves, the men, have left for work as well. But they're not disparaged unless they're known to be HIV positive, and that's a whole other issue. But it's a different rationale for respectability somewhat. Any questions from the audience? We're kind of please don't hesitate to ask our
have we bored everyone with discussions of sex tourism?
Let's hear from the young feminist scholars in the audience.
Well, I don't know whether you were. I don't know whether you were here to hear me read the paper that Karen Kelski was supposed to give, but it was a paper that showed very clearly the influence of Western feminism, and this was lesbian feminism, on lesbian feminists in Japan. And it seemed as if there was a dialogue or a kind of interaction going on between U.S. feminism in particular and Japanese feminism. And it makes, we are accustomed, I think, in this day and age, as many of you know, we're in the classroom, to think of feminism as something that's in the past. And we get very few students who these days self-identify as feminists.
How many feminists are in the house?
Yeah, good remark, and very Wendy, actually. But I mean, it was interesting to find out that something that we thought was kind of a dead letter here was actually invigorating in many ways activism and thinking in other countries. Who would have thought, without this very close reading of that Karen Kelski did of this lesbian text? I don't know how much you see this in the communities where you work, whether sort of the U.S. brand of feminism has had any sort of impact, and whether it's even known.
Well, I'm going to redirect it a little bit just to express the frustration I have with my current project. I think if you're a feminist scholar, everyone assumes that's all you're writing about.
Right.
And so as I'm doing field research here in the United States, interviewing men and women who were in different forms of forced labor, so sweatshop setting or agriculture, domestic servitude, and yes, brothels. And it's no one hears that. They assume, I mean, I don't literally mean once I take the podium, they don't hear it. But it's just assumed that if you've written about women and you've written about sex in particular, it's all you continue to write about. And there's an assumption that I'm writing about for sex now in both places, in the DR and here, which I'm not, and I didn't. So I'm both, I think it becomes all the more important to situate one's work as feminist scholarship. I mean, I do think that I'm teaching a gender class right now, and, well, I can say this because I emailed them the midterm yesterday. You know, one of the questions I emailed them was, can there be a feminist ethnography? And there's assumptions amongst generations in scholarship that we don't have to make gender a central analytical principle. Mm-hmm. But it's I do think it's frustrating for women scholars that if we're talking about other things, people still only hear you as talking about gender. I mean, here we are. Most of the participants today have been women, I've noticed, in the audience, you know, who's writing about gender. It's generally women. I don't know, Windance, what do you think?
I think it's still mainly women. I think there is a growing number of men. I mean, my gender courses are 20% male, but that's still a minority. But I think there's a growing number of primarily either gay men. I see more gay men writing about gender, or self-identified gay bisexual men. I think, for the most part, straight men or men who are presumed to be heterosexual are not doing that much on gender yet. So, yes, I think it's still a problem. I think the problem is we haven't convinced young men that this is their issue, too, that this is about masculinity. One of the things I've done in my classes now on gender is I have a whole section on masculinity and what men have to gain from feminism. And I teach in an article called How Feminism Made a Man Out of Me. Because I'd like to ask the young man in the back, like, whether when you hear that term, do you think it applies to you or any of the women in your life? Yeah, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm really interested. Like, you're here, so.
Yeah, I guess that works. I wouldn't say it applies to me because I haven't fully experienced the same things as those who would consider themselves feminists. However, I do know my sister and mother, I consider them very strong women, and with what little I know about feminism, I would consider them to be feminists because they're strong women, they know how to take care of themselves and others, and they are self-dependent. They don't need anyone else to tell them how to live their lives, so I'd consider them feminists.
What about you? You didn't raise your hand when we asked if they were feminists. Like, do you see yourself as a male feminist, or do you see,
I don't know what a male feminist is, to be honest. I guess that's just lack of knowledge on my part, but, I mean.
So you feel you have to know more feminist history to be a feminist?
I think it's more of a matter of being able to sympathize with what, or be able to relate, I guess, with feminist issues. I can honestly tell you that I don't have much knowledge of feminist issues, so I can't call myself a male feminist if I don't know what the feminist issues are.
Right. Well, you know, one thing I've been thinking about because of this scandal, you know, with baseball, with Roger Clemens, I've been thinking a lot about, I have three brothers, and all of them were in athletics at some point. None of them took steroids, as far as I know. But I've been thinking about how young men, particularly black men, who are in sports, are actually often forced to endure pain and do things to their bodies, to do things to their bodies that we think of women doing in order to, like, in other words, they have to achieve masculinity by subjecting their bodies to various forms of discipline, I guess you could say. And in some ways, I would argue that the process that a lot of young men go through in sports is really comparable to some of the things that women do or have done in order to be accepted. So I think that's one place to start for you, to think about whether you feel your body just belongs to you, or whether you have ever felt pressured, you know, to conform.
Or the drinking culture that is part and parcel of male identity, right, on college campuses, or let's just say at a certain age. And, I mean, that takes its toll on the body, too, especially when you're planted down in a toilet bowl. And certainly, right, the rituals in fraternities, which we were talking about with some students over lunch, that's you know, big part of Dickinson culture. So
it's funny that you should mention male athletes, because I played football for 4 years in high school, basketball for 3, and I was actually on the cheerleading squad here for the past 2 years, and that's just something that, you know, I chose to do. Like, I knew people on the team; they were nice, they're cool people, and they taught me how to do backflips and all sorts of other gymnastics. So I didn't have an issue doing that. Of course, I got a lot of flack for it, I guess, from my friends. But at this point, they've come to understand that. I mean, it's whatever. I plan on going back to play football this next semester, actually. So I don't know if that changes things, if that suddenly makes me a male feminist, because I'm doing something that's not typically male. But, I mean, it's always funny that you mentioned male athletics, because...
Well, it's something to think about. I mean, I'm thinking right now of male wrestlers in particular who have to drop weight, like, very quickly. I used to work with males who were bulimic or anorexic, and a lot of things they did were pretty similar to young girls, because they had to drop the weight, you know, to fight, to wrestle in the right category. Mm-hmm. And so they were doing a lot of really abusive things to their bodies that they were being pressured to do that were really made them more vulnerable and sick and everything. So check back in with us after you are on the team.
Are there, you know, wonderful, there's a, go ahead, please.
I wasn't able, is it on? I can't tell. I wasn't able to make it to Denise Brennan's talk this morning, and I was really curious about sort of, I don't know if you mentioned it already, but what inspires your work, and like sort of what made you interested in that field of work?
Feminism! Well, that's a great question. I think that I think young people think that professors were born professors. You know, the really exciting thing about a life of research and writing is that it can await you and you don't know it's out there. I was a very average student who was reasonably uninspired. And I was in college. And it took me a while I was always a feminist and always drawn to, I mean, this was the 80s, okay, so they really were women's issues. They weren't gender issues. And there were a lot of fights going on, and I was very involved as an activist. And, you know, eventually realized I wanted to do research. I had the opportunity when I was a master's student studying international relations to go to Cuba in like 1990 as a guest of the Cuban government. So I'll never be running for political office. But that blew my mind, the notion of, and I was doing research on women post-revolution who were still deploying now this revolutionary rhetoric about, revolutionary rhetoric that blamed them for passing on machismo to their sons. And these women were now standing back in bread lines and lines for rations, I shouldn't say bread lines, because the Soviets had just disengaged the bartering of sugar for oil. I got the bug, you know, of talking to people for a living and writing about it, and I wanted to study back in Cuba when I decided to go study anthropology, and for us anthropologists, it's sort of our bread and butter to go someplace for a long period of time, and it wasn't really possible for me to do that. And actually, this really sexist econ professor at Yale, I owe him a lot. He was in a Spanish class of mine, Spanish language class, and he literally, I was at the time negotiating, I was trying to get into Cuba to do some research one summer as a PhD candidate, and he leaned over to me and he said, I was just at this conference in Santo Domingo, this economics conference, and you'll be interested in this because you're one of those feminists. There were all these sex workers in the hotel. And that was it for me. I mean, I regathered my research money and redirected myself to the Spanish-speaking Caribbean. So what am I saying? That you can be fired up and engaged and charged on a set of issues, but not know how you're going to map them. And you have very little to lose, I think, when you keep yourself open to anything. And I get the most excited when I talk to my graduating seniors who don't know what they're doing in May. I think it takes a lot of guts. I'm fully aware that many folks have a lot of loans and there are rigorous payments. But it is the coolest thing to be able to follow things to get you fired up, to follow mm-hmm. what's in your gut. And I think it could take years sometimes to be able to work that out. But I have a bunch of graduating seniors that are, they don't know how they're going to cobble it together, but they're going to do it. You know, if they're waitressing at night and doing their thing, the thing that really charges them up by day. I quit banking. I was actually recruited by a Wall Street. This was the 80s when they actually hired silly liberal arts people. This would never happen today. But I think it takes, I mean, I know what it means to sort of, you know, you find what you love and you are the only person who's sort of doing that in your social networks. And I quit a job at a big international bank and I went and I worked at a running shop and figured out I should be working at that feminist think tank across town and thing, you know, it and feminist mentoring. I mean, I have every turn. Again, we're older than you, where feminist mentoring really mattered and it still does. I mean, I owe every opportunity that I've been given to a series of amazing, inspiring women. I don't even know what I'm saying anymore.
It's inspirational what you're saying. Are there any more questions from the audience? I think we're about ready to wrap it up if there are no more questions. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks to our guests.
And just please join me in thanking our panel. And on behalf of the Clark Forum, I would like to present each of you with a plaque.
Oh, thank you. Oh, wow.
Thank you very much.
Oh, really? Wow. That's beautiful.
Thank you so much. You designed that?
I did.
That is so cool.
You should say, I did.
I did.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah, nice. Thank you, Clark Forum. This is like a serious professional job here. This is awesome.
Wow.
This concludes our presentation, so thank you all for attending.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks.